Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Real Talks. I'm your host, David Steele. So we have kind of a very special show today. And so, as I made mention a couple tweets and the other, and you know, a little earlier yesterday, we have a special guest today. So I'm going to be welcoming him in a couple minutes. But I wanted to really start out with some really sad news. And it's not movie related, but unfortunately, there has been a passing, and there is our guest, Jeremy Fowler. Thank you, Jeremy, for being here. Hello. Unfortunately, Tina Turner has passed away. So she was an absolute, now while she wasn't, you know, I mean, she was in a few movies. I mean, let's be honest, okay? I mean, I'm always partial to Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, but so she was an icon. There's no other way around this. And so I wanted to actually, she was 83, not 80, I stand corrected. So I wanted to read, actually, it's Jeremy's colleague from The Wrap, Sharon, wrote this. So Tina Turner, whose musical career spanned decades, has died at the age of 83, a spokeswoman said in a statement on Wednesday. Her hits include the 1970s Proud Mary and her big comeback from the 1980s, What's Love Got to Do with It. Born Anna Mae Bullock on November 26, 1939, she came to the stage named Tina Turner when she married producer Ike Turner. Her story of surviving her abuse was made into the 1993 film, What's Love Got to Do with It. So quickly, like, since this is like the first thing that, I mean, this literally just dropped as I was getting started. What are your first memories, or give me a couple of songs from Tina Turner that you really enjoy, Jeremy?
Well, for me, being that I was so into movies, I think like a lot of other cinephiles, I first discovered Tina through Beyond Thunderdome. That movie, hearing about her death, I thought so much about how Mad Max as a series so dramatically changed from one movie to the next. And Beyond Thunderdome, I think, was a big part of that. It became more than just the Mel Gibson thing. She was just as big of a star in that movie as Gibson was. And I think of Spin the Wheel, Make the Deal, and how she just had this incredible presence that you wouldn't really even think of. You know, if you thought, obviously people thought of her as a pop star, but here she is in this wildly different role. And she just owned it. And that for me is what I think of most when I think of Tina Turner.
Yeah, I mean, she was just an absolute legend all the way around. I mean, just in the, not only just her music, but her career and being able to, I mean, how many, and this is what I loved about her. I mean, you know, how many women would actually have the confidence of actually getting on stage and, you know, doing that? And her voice, forget about her voice. I mean, her voice was just magical in every single facet. Yeah, this is a tragic loss. She wasn't inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, several years ago, as she should have been. You know, there was, you know, a couple of movies, you know, made about her, you know, so that is just a sad, sad piece of news. But anyways, so I wanted to actually formally welcome my guest to the show. His writing career began shortly, almost 10 years ago, in the National Art Festival in Grahamstown, South Africa. The next year, he went on to graduate from USC School of Journalism. His outstanding writing has earned him 2 Los Angeles Press Awards, one for his USC student protests and the other for his piece, Hollywood's Homeless Crisis, Meet a Musical Legend, B.B. King, Now Living on the Streets. Currently, he writes daily articles for The Wrap, Wrap Pro, I should say, one of the major titles, the Trades in Hollywood, specializing in the box office. And we're going to talk a lot about the box office today. When he's not writing or watching movies, you can catch him at the theater and at the concerts, because I know you're a huge musical fan, and he enjoys sports. Currently, he's doing a weekly space with our friend Scott Mendelson, who was actually on the show about a year ago, so that was great to see, about movie news and all of the results. And as I said, it is my pleasure to welcome Jeremy Fowler. How are you?
Hey, David. Thanks for having me on here. We're juggling. I'm juggling many different hats right now, covering strike and a very busy summer box office season. But I'm glad I would be able to take the time to talk a bit, because we've been chatting on Twitter DMs, and I have a chance to be here talking on camera.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. So let's just, I got to ask off the top, like, so where did this love of movies first start?
You know, I think part of it was just I grew up here in LA, and I grew up next to Valley College in the San Fernando Valley, and it's about just a mile away from, it was back then a Century Theaters, now it's a Cinemark North Hollywood 8-screen, and tickets were just dirt cheap, so we just went to a bunch of movies. And you know, my parents would take me to, you know, to the kid movies. I would beg them to see the Pokemon movie and all this stuff. But I think I remember it was when I was 11, and I just saw these all these TV spots for Master and Commander. And I feel like that was the first like grown-up movie that I saw. But it looked a lot to me like Pirates of the Caribbean at the time, even though I knew it was more like intense and stuff, but we saw it opening weekend, and it's such an incredible, the craft on it is so incredible. It was so jarring for me for the first time. Oh yes, you're showing my Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah, so I was actually gonna say this, but it just popped up. So Mr. Jeremy here has been on a national televised game show, so we'll get to that picture a little bit later. Though
that came from being really, really bored in lockdown and really needing to get out of the house and realizing, hey, they're only casting for Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune in SoCal. Let me just give this a shot.
So Master and Commander. Yeah. I mean, Russell Crowe was a phenomenal movie back in the day. Yeah. I mean, you started writing for the Wrap when? 2016?
I joined the Wrap in January 2016. One moment, I got Leaf Blower coming by my apartment. Mm-hmm. And for a year, it was just like I wasn't a full-time staffer. I was like 1099, and I was just writing traffic-y stuff. I wasn't doing the box office stuff. I wasn't sure how long I was going to be sticking around, but then after a year, the previous box office writer had to leave the site for personal reasons, and they said, hey, we have a spot open, and before we start putting out the hiring, we want to go internal. Do you want to give doing box office a shot? So yeah, I became the box office reporter in 2017. First few films that I was covering at the time were Get Out. Get Out was the first big box office hit that I looked at, which was a film that just kept going and going and going. I made a lot of mistakes that first year. I thought that I wrote up a thing about how the summer 2017 box office is going to be huge, and it ended up being a big downswing from the previous year with 2016. But then it just kept going to like 2018, 2019, where everything was
working. And then, of course, 2019 happened when it was just, oh my God.
Yeah, 2019, you know? Like everything was working from the big blockbusters all the way down to what you have multiple hit documentaries at the time. And then came the pandemic. So there's been a lot of highs and lows in the 6 years that I've been doing this beat. And the phrase that I always use with the box office is stubborn optimism. Like everybody in the movie theaters and film, just like, people are going to come back to theaters. We really believe they're going to come back to theaters. And most of the time it pays off. I still think there are concerns about where the box office is headed. I'm still very concerned that Oscar movies are going to be on their way out of theaters unless studios like Apple and Amazon are willing to just fork down the money to pay Scorsese or Ridley or whoever, whatever big movies they have, just for the prestige of it and to get eyes on streaming later on down the line. I'm worried about that. But the box office has recovered way more than I think some people thought it was going to. A lot of people felt like it was going to be permanently diminished. And we're seeing more and more movies performing the way they would in 2018 or 2019. Now it's just a matter of, can the whole market get back to where it was in 2019?
And I think this is the first year, at least for me speaking, this is the first year that we have something in there for everybody, right? I mean, we have Barbie coming out, you know, later on in July. We've got all these action, we've got action movies and Mission Impossible and, you know, The Flash and everything else. And I think there's something across the board for everybody, and even animated titles. You know, the new Spider-Man movie that's going to be coming out in a couple of weeks. So this is the first time that really you're able to see an all performing box office. And I think it's great. And, you know, this whole year, the rest of the year is stacked. I mean, whether you're talking about Dune 2, Killers of the Flower Moon, you know, and a couple others, even on Netflix, some of the big budget movies. Do you think that, you know, especially in the summer months coming up, do you think that any of these movies are going to get cannibalized? You know, so, I mean, because June is a killer's row, as you know.
That's definitely something that is on my mind. Like there's a lot of stuff, and I would not be surprised if there's a movie there, that if a certain movie comes out that gets good reviews, but because there's just so much, it just gets squeezed out. Right now, the one that I think is going to get squeezed out is going to be Elemental, because we're going to get official tracking for it. Like the numbers you're seeing online right now, which is like 28 to 38 million. That's from Box Office Pro, is one of a guy I call regularly, Sean Robbins. He makes good estimates, but those aren't like the official estimates that studios get from firms like data firms like NRG and MarketCast and things like that. Those get released 3 weeks before a week. So we're going to get tracking for Flash and Elemental tomorrow. And I think right now with Elemental, it's this situation where it might just be that families are still in the idea of, oh, it's going to be coming out on Disney Plus. Even if they're taking their families out to see, you know, Super Mario or Puss in Boots, like Universal, they'll release those movies on digital rental like 4 or 5 weeks after it comes out in theaters, but they don't put it out on streaming. Like they have the mentality of that they have shown, what they tell me is that digital rental doesn't eat into box office, but if you put it on streaming, then it will. Because the consumer will look at the price tag of like what, $14.99, $19.99, and maybe some families will watch it there, but a lot of other families will just want to get out of the house and they'll go for a discount rate or something. They'll go to a discount movie theater or something like that. But streaming, then it's just like, oh, we'll just buy some Orville Redenbacher popcorn and just hit play and watch with our families there.
And I think that, you know, I did the piece that you wrote the other day about Fast 10 and the big concern. So you were basically saying, I mean, because let's face it. So anybody who hasn't seen Fast 10, okay, it has a $340 million budget, which is huge. And right now, I mean, it did really well overseas, which is good to see. It made $67.5 million here opening weekend. For me personally, it's not about the opening weekend, but it's the second weekend. I mean, if you take a look at something like Guardians of the Galaxy 3, that opened, granted it was a Marvel film, and it has only made for, you know, 11, 12 years, but it had legs. It made $60 million last weekend, okay? It only dropped 48%. And then this weekend, it made $32 to $33 million. So that's a major thing too. Now, let me ask you this. Do you think if one film, because we are so congested, do you think if one film stumbles, that's going to open the door for another film to basically get that money that opening weekend one had?
It could, but it depends on what movies we're talking about. Like if Elemental stumbles, that doesn't necessarily mean that, say, like 2 weeks later, Indiana Jones is going to pick all of that up. I would say that I feel like with Fast 10, I'm hearing for this weekend domestically, the 3 day weekend is going to be around 27 to 30 million. The 4 day is going to be around 34, 35 million. That's par for the course legs. It's not a birdie or an eagle, to use a golf analogy like Guardians said. It's par. Unfortunately, given the budget for Fast 10 needs birdies and putts. But what's interesting is that when you look at the international, right now, from what I'm hearing from people internationally, they're expecting Fast 10 to take a bite out of the Little Mermaid. Because right now the tracking for Little Mermaid overseas isn't as big as the domestic side. So that's kind of the relationship that you're seeing here, where Fast 10 is stumbling a little bit domestically, and that's allowing a little bit more for Little Mermaid. And yeah, Little Mermaid is also going to get big support from families, but it's also a good chunk of general audiences that aren't interested in Fast 10 that maybe want to see Halle Bailey play Ariel. Whereas overseas, Fast 10 is doing really well in a lot of other markets, and that is sort of having an impact on the interest for foreign audiences. Like, they seeing a Hollywood blockbuster, they might go see Fast 10 instead of Little Mermaid. There's maybe more stiffer competition over there. That's something that, again, like, we're still in the process of learning how much the theatrical market can support multiple films with really big budgets. We got a bit of a preview of that in March when we had all these different films coming out. But at the same time, there's only so much we can take from that, because Shazam just critically did not do as well as the first Shazam. And so that allowed it to easily die off. But we did see, like, Creed and John Wick sort of coexist. And then you had Dungeons and Dragons, which had good reception, just fell off. So that's something we're going to be learning about this summer. As more films come out, we're going to see what kind of films they are, how well they're received, and then how well they compete against films that might have a similar core audience.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it's one of those things, because it is so closely knit. I mean, one of my, and I've been raving about this film for months and months and months, is Mission Impossible. And Mission Impossible is funny, because we were talking, like, we were in a space the night after the Oscars, or the night of the Oscars, after the show. And there had been nothing. I mean, nothing about this film. And it was you who actually sent me a DM and said, oh, look at this. And I went, what is it? And so it was a poster. It was the first official, like, promotional poster. And I went, this, you know, because people Photoshop and everything else, I said, is this real? So, of course, I went on IMDb Pro, which I'm like, oh, wow, this is real. So finally, it was one of those things where we're starting to slowly get this. And I got to be honest, like, I, you know, obviously the second trailer came out and everything else, excited is an understatement. My biggest fear, so one of the films that I'm looking forward to, just to see the aesthetic and everything else, is Barbie. So it's one of those things, but, and here's the big but, and I'm not trying to be critical, the fact that it is the second weekend of Mission Impossible, because it is coming up the 19th. Actually, Mission Impossible moved it up from the 14th to the 12th. But beyond that, so you have an Oppenheimer coming up. It's going to be the second weekend of Mission Impossible. Let me ask you this question. Do you think Barbie should move to, let's say, August, to try and get some of that stuff? Or do you think it should stay where it is?
I think you can stay put. I mean, first off, just one other thing I want to mention before. I'm going on a bit of a tangent here, but I just think one thing that really fascinates me on Mission Impossible. So, like you said, that move to Wednesday. I think Paramount saw what Universal did with Mario and realized, hey, if we're feeling really, really good about a movie, maybe we can put it out on Wednesday and allow that opening day audience to really get the word of mouth going. And then it just cascades into a huge Friday to Sunday. Mario did that incredibly well. And why not do it with Tom Cruise's Top Gun Maverick? And they're also going to be doing it with the Ninja Turtles movie. Like, so I feel like when you see a movie move from a Friday release to a Wednesday release, you're going to be seen as a sign of the studio really, really feeling like they've got a winner there. Now, to answer your question about Barbie, you know, I feel like Barbie is enough of a different, it's different enough from Mission Impossible and from Oppenheimer to warrant this. You know, I feel like we've become so used to one movie just dominating the charts that it's easy to forget that once upon a time, counter-programming was a thing. You know, if you've got a movie that is responsibly budgeted, and you feel like is tonally and in terms of core audience different from everything else, then why not put it against an Oppenheimer? Why not put it against a Tom Cruise movie? And yeah, I think the core audience for a Barbie crowd, it's going to be probably more female skewing, but in general, it's just being a comedy, just being this really smart, self-aware comedy that is going to draw a core audience, is going to be different from from the Mission Impossible crowd, different from the Oppenheimer crowd, and you hope gets in enough of of general audiences to keep on making a profit. I'm more concerned about Oppenheimer, but that's just because it's a movie about nukes, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is too, everybody knows about World War II, it's more of a macro thing, but they don't know about the man.
Yeah.
Right. They don't know about who he had to do, you know, what they had to deal with, you know, back in 1945 and everything else. I think the fact that the two good things I will say about Oppenheimer is this. Number one, you have a cast that is stellar. Okay. Cillian Murphy, Emily Blunt, Matt Damon, so on. Then on top of that, you have a director that is a hard hitting director, so to speak. I mean, look, he can do sci-fi and Interstellar. Okay. But he's also done something like, you know, Inception, or, I mean, and by the way, we're going to be doing it for the perfect movie coming up in June, guys, The Dark Knight and the whole Batman thing, not to mention Interstellar and everything else. So I think that in itself, but to your point, though, they don't know the man. And I think with the runtime of 3 hours, and look, runtimes have gone out the window. I've always said, the film is good, if the story is good, I don't care how long it is. I mean, look, Killers of the Flower Moon. Killers of the Flower Moon is 3 hours and 29 minutes. Okay. I'm in all in for that. I mean, yes, it is, of course, it is, but people forget, like The Irishman was 3.5 hours. So it's one of those things where I'm really looking. That's one of my other ones I'm looking forward to. So let's transition from summer to fall. What are some of the things that you're really, I mean, so I've talked about a couple of them. Okay, Dune 2 and Killers of the Flower Moon. What are some of the other ones that you really, I mean, I'm not asking to project anything. What are some of the ones that you're really looking forward to that have release dates that you say, I've got to be in the theater to see that?
Well, when I think about the fall, I'm moving a bit away from your question here, but when I think about the fall, I'm not so much thinking about specific films as much as I'm thinking about the vibes about the Oscar season. Because this is part of the reason why I'm concerned about Oppenheimer. No other director other than Nolan would get a studio to drop $100 million plus and have IMAX make black and white film for a movie about nukes. It's just that what I think about films like The Fabelmans, Banshees of Inisherin, She Said, a lot of films that came out last fall that premiered at Toronto and Venice that were big prestige films and then did next to nothing at the box office. And the one thing they all had in common was that these were very serious films tackling very real life issues. And right now there isn't an audience for that, at least not theatrically. Like the people are showing that when they want a distraction from real life issues rather than a reminder of it.
They want to be entertained.
Yeah.
They want to be entertained at the end of the day.
And so that is my big worry when I look at an Oppenheimer or Killers of the Flower Moon. Personally, for me, I am in the bag for these movies. I'm in the bag for Ridley Scott's Napoleon. We saw that at CinemaCon, but as I was watching, I was thinking, wow, I love this, the incredible technical craft of this. They're showing Joaquin Phoenix as Napoleon firing cannons on a retreating army going across the ice. He's not aiming at the soldiers, he's aiming at the ice they're on to kill them all in the freezing waters. And it's incredibly technically sound, but I'm just thinking, who's going to buy a ticket for this?
An Academy Award winner.
Yeah, like for
I mean, and that's the thing. I was just having that. Okay, so let's go back. I was just having this debate with somebody the other day. Okay, Tom Cruise. So there was a piece I did, I think it was yesterday or the day before, about how somebody had said there are no more movie stars left. And I would argue, I think Tom Cruise is the last movie star. Now, in Hollywood today. That all being said, he is an Academy Award winner, and Joaquin has taken some, I mean, Joker, Gladiator was amazing. He's done The Master and everything else. Joker put him on the map. He can do whatever he wants. We know this. I think people are going to be there for that. And to your point, if I had to guess, I would think Napoleon would do better overseas than would here in the States, just because. Now, I have no indication about that, but all that being said, I think Joaquin Phoenix is a great actor. He just doesn't get the recognition. I mean, yes, he does. He won the Oscar for Joker, but he's not in that conversation with like a Tom Cruise or Bradley Cooper or put any other male, Ryan Reynolds, Ryan Gosling, or anybody else. No, I agree with you. So you were just speaking about CinemaCon. So tell me some of the things at CinemaCon that you really thoroughly enjoyed.
Well, like I said, the Ridley Scott piece was one of them. You didn't see it in the trailer for Oppenheimer, but they showed us an extended clip from Oppenheimer, one of the black and white scenes. We got to see a big section of Robert Downey Jr. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy he played. Lewis, I forget his last name. He's the head of Atomic Energy Commission. But it's a black and white scene where he comes up. His name is Lewis Strauss. And he comes up and he tells them that the Soviets have successfully created like a detonator, some significant step towards creating an atom bomb. And they believe that the only way they could have possibly made it that fast is if they've got a spy at Los Alamos and they got this espionage afoot. And Oppenheimer says, I thought we were racing against the Nazis, not the Soviets. And kind of the impression I get is that's sort of the beginning of, I'm thinking that what's going to be is he's showing Oppenheimer, he's convinced he has to make this bomb before the Nazis do. And he's convinced that doing that will bring, as you hear in the trailer, a peace the world's ever known. But now he's starting to realize that that's not what's going to happen.
Well, that's the scene too, I think, in the trailer. And, you know, Matt Damon's sitting at a table and he's like, he's got 12 months head start. And he's like, well, they have an 18 month head start. He's like, how do you know that?
That was a movie that really, really impressed me. In terms of crowd pleaser movies, because I movie about nukes, I'm hoping people will come out and see this because it's Nolan, but it does make me wonder.
I think he has a very niche audience. Would you agree?
I think there's going to be a hardcore group of like Nolan fans that will come out to see it. I'm just wondering if at that budget level it's going to work. Like the Dunkirk is the standard for this. Like if it makes around $500 million worldwide, Universal will take that as well. Another movie that I was really impressed by is Wish. They showed us the full segment of like what's going to be the big song. You hear it in the trailer. You hear a snippet of it in the trailer. It's really, really gorgeous. It's sort of taking what they developed a decade ago with Paper Man, of that blend of let's do a 2D watercolor-ish style but with 3D animation. It looks fantastic. The song is spectacular. That is a movie of all the fall movies. That is the one I'm most interested in seeing how it does box office wise, especially if Elemental fails to really attract an audience. I've been told by Disney that now that Iger's back in charge, they're really trying to get families to not wait to Disney Plus and come back out to the theaters again. Yeah. Movie theaters and Disney really, really, really need Wish to work, especially if Elemental flops, because that is a movie that has the Frozen formula. You know, marketable Disney princess. It's a musical. You got a goofy, funny sidekick. You know, it's got this gorgeous 3D animation. It's got everything that the Frozen, you'd seen a Frozen or a Moana. And if that doesn't work, then
you have to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, not only to go back to the drawing board, but it's just, you know, we're already in a new world in animation right now where it's not just Disney in a clear first place and DreamWorks and animation doing a respectable second. Illumination is the new top dog now. DreamWorks is on the come up. And then you've got Sony Animation and Paramount Animation rapidly ramping up their production. Maybe at some point Warner Animation is going to get back into the game. It's we're at a point where we're going to be seeing more animated movies, and it's no longer just Disney's just the undisputed king. They might be a significant player again if Wish works, but there is something about their marketing right now that just isn't working. I think the films are working. I think Strange World wasn't a bona fide classic, but I thought it was very, very good. But they're having a hard time marketing these movies, and something's going to have to change. And if they can't market the most easily marketable animated movie they've got on the future slate, then they're in trouble.
So let me ask you a question. You're saying that. So how do you think they turn it around?
You know, I think part of it might just be a longer play of just trying to undo what Chapek did, where Chapek was just so putting all the chips on streaming that it acclimated a good chunk of families to just waiting until streaming. It's one of those things where Disney Plus kind of works against them. I think Disney Plus is going to start being profitable once they start reducing the costs and how much they spent on making stuff for it. But they were getting to a point where they had so many families subscribe to Disney Plus compared to like Peacock. Like, I would say like less than 10% of the families that have Disney Plus also have Peacock. So for families who really want to see Mario, they're going to go out to see that because they don't have Peacock. And whereas with Disney, I think maybe they see these movies and it's like, you know, we wait until streaming, unless they really get blown away by it and really want to see it in theaters. So they really have to put the work in to get audiences to come back to theaters instead of just, you know, they'll have to string out how long they wait until they put a new movie that has been in theaters out on Disney Plus. I think it is also a matter of just the marketing of how they sell these films, depending on the premise. You know, Elemental isn't a musical. They really have to find a way to really market the visual imaginativeness of this. Like, they showed us the first 20 minutes at CinemaCon, and I'm watching this thinking, God, they must have been a blast to storyboard. There's all these really smart visual gags of, you know, of Ember, the fire character. She breaks something, and she's apologizing to her dad about losing her temper while she's eating the glass and then blowing it out into a new jar. And it's just like, it's just that kind of fun stuff. Like, God, that's got to be really fun to animate. They're having there's a lot of imagination going on in that world, and they got to convey it to people, and they got to make them want to see it in theaters. That's what, it's easy to do that when it's Mario and it's like, ooh, it's the water jetpack from Mario Sunshine, or it's that thing.
The Easter eggs.
It's a thing that from that game I played on the N64 or the SNES or the GameCube or whatever. It's easy to do it when you've got a marketable IP, when you've got an original film like Elemental. They got to find a way to be able to do that again. They used to.
Yeah. Okay. So I got to ask, and I know there were a couple of, obviously no spoilers for me, but I got to ask because you were at CinemaCon and there were a couple of screenings the other day, and we were almost a little less than a month away.
The Flash.
So you saw The Flash on a scale from 1 to 10, 1 being this was the worst superhero movie ever made. 10 was this is better than The Dark Knight and it's going to make $1 billion. Okay, 7.
Yeah,
and that's pretty good.
I'll be honest. Like, when I came out of Guardians Volume 3, I was like pumping my fists. Like, oh my God, I thought I was never going to love a superhero movie this much ever again. Like, that, the more time gets away from me watching it, like, the first Guardians and Black Panther were my 1A and 1B. This might top both of them. Like, I came out gushing about that one. The Flash, I have my colleague Umberto Gonzalez, who is our big superhero guy, he loved The Flash more than the Guardians. So as I was watching the movie, I was thinking, okay, I think hardcore DC fans are really going to love it. I think they're going to love the humor of it. The opening 15 minutes is fantastic. There's this big moment where it's a hospital blowing up, and Batfleck and the Flash have to save a maternity ward from getting blown up. But the Flash hasn't had his morning breakfast, so he has a low calorie.
Okay, I don't want to get you to spoil anything.
No. I mean, like,
okay.
The setup, but it just leads to a really humorous and clever, visually clever opening action sequence, and it's really fun.
Nice.
The rest of it, I think what's going to be interesting is that I think it's going to really win over. It's going to win over all the DC fans except like the hardcore Snyder fans who are just refusing to like this movie no matter what. My interest is how the Ezra of it all is going to affect how casual fans see this. Without spoiling, what I will say is that when people watch this movie, you're going to see why you can't just recast Ezra Miller. He's not just the lead actor of the film. He is the film.
Wow.
Like, you know how in the trailer you see him meeting his alternate timeline itself, that's like 80% of the movie. It's a huge chunk of the movie is just Ezra talking with Ezra. And to credit, it's really good. There's a lot of really funny moments out of all of that. But I do wonder for the people who aren't like constantly online like you and I are, who don't know that much about Ezra, they'll come and watching this movie and I think they're really gonna like it. And they're like, wow, who is this guy? I wanna look him up. Then you look him up and it's like
okay, we've got problems here.
How does that affect the word of mouth?
Well, and you know, so I did stories about this over a year ago and everything else. It's gonna be I think Warner Brothers has gotten to the point where they just need to put this out.
Yeah.
I mean, once, you know, and that's the thing about it is, it's going to be very front loaded and then it's going to do what it's going to do. And whether it takes a hit or it is profitable or whatever, it's going to be out. So let's fast forward past The Flash, because as everybody knows, James Gunn is now taking over DC Studios. Yeah. Tell me, do you think, I mean, obviously, it's way too early to tell because he hasn't even put out Superman Legacy yet. But do you think, knowing what you know about James Gunn today, about Guardians and the Suicide Squad and everything else, do you think he can actually do this? And actually, I'm not saying in 4 years, okay? That's just how long his contract is. I'm talking, do you think he can actually really build a DCU to rival Marvel?
At this point, I mean, if...
It's too early to tell right now.
But if anybody has a shot of doing it, it would be him. You know, I think this is a moment where I feel like Warner Brothers is really, really pumping their fists that Guardians 3 has been as well received as it is. Because even though it's 2 years, I think that goodwill is going to transfer over for a lot of general audiences. I think people will recognize that, hey, he may, especially if they market it as from the director of the Guardians of the Galaxy films, they will remember how much they like all three of those Guardians films and think, hey, the Guardians guy's making a Superman movie. There will be a lot of curiosity for that because James Gunn contains multitudes. You know, you have the sentimental, very heartfelt James Gunn. And you also have the trauma James Gunn, like that was the James Gunn that did the Suicide Squad. And we actually saw a melding of them, I think, in Volume 3. You would have these really emotional moments with Rocket. Then you would have the High Evolutionary getting his face ripped off. And that's trauma. That is pure. The guy who looks like a carrot is trauma James Gunn. So I feel like people are going to look at that. And then also, if you read what he said about how he wants to do Superman in the spirit of Grant Morrison's All-Star Superman, if you ever read that, it's like the greatest Superman comic ever in the eyes of a lot of people. I think it would create a lot of curiosity of, okay, how does the guy who made that, the Suicide Squad, the Guardians, make a Superman movie? How does he approach making a Superman movie? And if he nails that, and I feel pretty confident he will, I think DC is off to the races because you have that goodwill. And I think that is what both Marvel and DC are lacking right now is that audience goodwill. The Flash, it might work as a one-off. Guardians is working well, but I also hear people say, I really like Guardians. I think this is a good getting off point for me with the MCU. Like, they like Guardians, but they're not really interested in seeing what's next. They don't have that trust anymore that where it's going next is going to be good. You need that. Marvel once had that. They don't have it as much now. DC definitely doesn't have it, but could get it back with James. It's hard to say. So far, nobody else has replicated the cinematic universe formula to the degree that Marvel has. But at least James has that experience of working within one. And he's talked with Kevin Feige a lot, so maybe he's learned.
I was going to say, so he has a template in trying to, you know, he has it. So I got a couple more questions real quick. Number one, casting. Everybody loves fan casting. I mean, I do it too, and, you know, I'm guilty of this. What I'd like you to do, if you could, Who would you like, if you had your choice of anybody, who would you want to see don the cape to play Superman and Superman
Legacy? I genuinely, I'm very much in the line of, the reason why I personally don't do the fan casting, especially for a movie like this, is because I can't get into James Gunn's mind of what he wants.
That's understood.
Like he sort of wants like, you know how we have like Batman Year One?
Yes.
And it's sort of like that's Superman Year One.
Yeah.
Like a guy who, he knows he's Superman. He knows who he is, but the world doesn't know who he is. And he still has to build that relationship. And he's also trying to figure out how to be Clark Kent Cub reporter for the planet. That is a very specific, role that requires a younger actor. I don't know how many young actors, established young actors out there. I can't think of any that I would immediately fan cast. I wouldn't be surprised if he casts a relative unknown, like someone like an Austin Butler, he had experience, but this was clearly the biggest role he's ever done. And I wouldn't be surprised if Gunn goes in that direction. And I think at this point is probably what he should do. You know, with the Batman, you could hire Robert Pattinson, probably because even when people were unfairly saying, oh, he's a Twilight guy, when anybody who paid attention to him knew he wasn't just the Twilight guy.
Right.
At the very least, people were used to Batman being like recast and rebooted in that way that...
Well, I think that's why Batman, the Batman works so well, is because we've had other Batman before, with Ben Affleck or Michael Keaton or Val Kilmer, and they'd all been established. This film that Matt Reeves did was a year one, year two Batman. And it was a complete, he was still trying to figure himself out and be the quote, world's greatest detective. And I think that's what Gunn is trying to do with the Superman film, is Superman has now been Superman only for a little bit. And he's trying to balance his professional, his personal, and he's trying to be a superhero to everybody.
And I would have to look in the comics to see. I don't know if that stage of Superman has been explored in the comics, but I don't think it's something that people are as familiar at the way people, I think, had a general idea, because there have been some Batman media about that early stage Batman, to the point that I think people could at least see, okay, Robert Pattinson, you know, he's got that age that could work. I don't know if there is that familiarity with what that sort of Clark Kent / Superman would be, in how people would visualize it from previous media, that they can immediately say, oh, that actor would be good for that kind of Superman. It feels, at least to me, like uncharted territory. And I could be wrong on that, but that's why I'm kind of on the favor of Gunn should probably go for somebody that people don't know yet.
Okay. And so one of the last topics we're going to talk about today, it's the elephant in the room. Everybody's talking about it. And this is basically shut down the business for 3 weeks. And that's the writer's strike. You know, how do you think this strike, because right now, for the rest of 2023 and some of 2024, we're going to have productions and shows and streaming, and it's going to be all fun. But there's going to come a point, at some point, where... And you did, I think you either put out a tweet or actually wrote a story about this, saying you wouldn't be surprised if this thing didn't last the whole summer. So let me ask you this. How do you think that this is going to affect Hollywood in general moving forward? And, you know, when do you think we might start to feel the effects of it?
Well, when you say feel the effects of it, are we talking about TVs? Or are we talking about
just in general?
Because we're already going to be feeling it with TV, because May and June is the time of year when the writers' rooms get together for the fall TV season, start their writing. So that whole process is already getting moved back. It's not going, this is going to go on, it's locked in that it's going to go on through the end of June, because the studios have to continue their negotiations with the Directors Guild, which are happening right now. And then right after that, they go in to talk to SAG-AFTRA through the end of June. Now, they either get a deal with both of those, or they don't get a deal with SAG-AFTRA, and then we have writers and actors on strike. I'm not going to go down the timeline of that because that just goes into territory that we haven't seen since 1960. 1960 was when the last time both the Writers Guild and SAG-AFTRA went on strike. And that strike is the reason why we have residuals in Hollywood. That could lead to dramatic change. But we're I feel like I shouldn't get into that before.
No, that's fine.
So let's go with the scenario where they do reach a deal with SAG-AFTRA. We just got the writers.
Okay.
Even beyond that, the studios have an incentive to wait this thing out until mid-August. And my sources tell me mid-August would be around the time where all the studios can use what they call a force majeure clause to break, to terminate production deals. Right now, you got all this Wall Street telling all these studios, you're losing money, you need to cut costs, all of this. So all the studios, what they're using for them, the strike is an opportunity to just spread out, look at what they're paying right now, look at all these production deals and say, that deal with J.J. Abrams isn't delivering the way we thought we would. We're going to terminate that clause. We're going to terminate this production clause. Now, those writers are going to find – these are high-profile writers we're talking about. We're talking about Ryan Murphy, Abrams, Shonda Rhimes, people like that. They'll find jobs elsewhere, which the studios also have to prepare for. Like, you know, you have to not only be willing to terminate a deal with somebody who will not work again with you, but also is going to go work for a competitor. But they will do that to really dramatically cut down the costs. So it could pay off. It could take billions of dollars off the books, depending on how many deals they terminate. Once we get back to that point, that's when things get interesting, because from what I've heard, the legacy studios, Disney's, the Warner Brothers, the Universals, they're going to really want to get back to work after that. So the question is, do they start pressuring the streamers to come back to the negotiating table? The streamers are the ones that, from what I heard, were not really willing to answer all the demands that the Writers Guild wanted addressed. And that's the reason why talks ended without a deal. Does that split between the studios and the streamers start to widen because the legacy studios have more of a pressure to get back to work with the writers than the streamers might? That is the harder question. And whether or not they do is going to really affect what terms are made in the deal. Because the WGA are just saying, like, you have to compromise with us on everything. You can't just ask us to drop a certain thing if you don't like. You can compromise on everything, but you have to give us a counterproposal on everything we are demanding. And the details of that will determine how much Hollywood significantly changes in terms of how writers are compensated, in terms of whether younger writers of today can actually become the showrunners of tomorrow, or if they get stuck in an infinite loop. And will also probably affect how films get picked up by streaming. Because right now, there are a lot of feature writers, I'm writing this up about how feature writers are struggling with getting paid for streaming, or they're not getting paid as much as they would for legacy studios, even though streamers are picking up more of these films. There's a lot of, it's very hard to predict where all of that is going, but what I feel pretty safe in predicting is that it's not going to be until August or September that there will even be a possibility that all of this gets resolved.
Okay, so let's move on to something lighter. Okay, so you're sitting home, it's a Sunday afternoon, you have nothing to do, you're relaxing. What does Jeremy put on for a movie?
That's kind of hard, because I will confess that while I watch a lot of movies, I generally like to go to find what's a new one in theaters. Like, for me, if I'm doing nothing, I want to find a new movie at the Lamley Santa Monica what's one that I haven't heard about that I want to see. Although it's not a movie, it's a mini series. I am right now getting around to watching The Offer, Paramount Plus, about the making of The Godfather.
Because yes.
I got the
Mark,
book
over here. Mark Rylance?
No, it's I got a book over here, Take the Gun, Leave the Cannoli, about the making
of The Godfather. Okay.
And it's yes. that, you know, while certain creative changes had to be made in The Offer, it is really fascinating just reading about how that movie was made and how it almost feels too Hollywood-esque to hear it be said that what was considered like the greatest movie of all time was people were convinced that it was going to be a bomb. And people inside,
I still do that today.
Yeah, and there's a character, Colin Hanks. They had to change his name in the series, but he represents Jack Ballard, who was an executive at Paramount, who was basically the bean counter and was convinced that The Godfather was going to cost them billions and was trying his damnedest to get Coppola fired. And it led to Coppola being forced to fire four or five members of his crew, including a longtime editing partner, because he thought that they were all part of a coup. And he later said that his editing partner, he realizes, probably wasn't in on it, but that was kind of, it was up to the point where he realized they're going to fire me on Monday. I have the weekend to fire the people who are going to get me. And it's almost like, it's almost like Michael Corleone realizing they want to have a meeting with me. They're going to whack me. So I'm going to get them before they get me. It's just this weird moment of life kind of sort of imitating art. And if you ever watch it, it's really fascinating just seeing how this movie had to navigate so many pitfalls, including dealing with the actual mobsters who were all wanted to get in with this. They all charmed Pacino and Brando, especially Brando, so they could all hang out around the set and watch all of this. And it's just this weird melding of fiction and reality. It's amazing how the story of how The Godfather is made is just as compelling as the movie itself.
Nice. All right. So the last thing, and I kind of showed it earlier. So He goes on Wheel of Fortune. This is something I just found off the top. Wow. That's cool. So that was your experience. Like, did you have a good time? Was it,
Yeah.
Did you win?
Well, I didn't get to the bonus round, but I did get enough money to buy Super Bowl tickets. So that
nice.
Was
nice.
So that was my, that was, I was like, I they actually, after when we finished rolling, I won like $8,500.
Nice. Cool.
As we're walking off, Sajak says, got an idea what you're going to spend it on? And I told him, if the Rams make the Super Bowl, I'm spending it on that. So,
I love game shows. I can remember I was this high watching The Price is Right back in the 80s and everything else. And one of the great, I think it would be a hell of a script, started to develop a little bit of a script for, and you can Google all this stuff if you don't know, it's Richard Larson from Pressure.
Oh, yes. I am.
Yes. Okay. So you know, anybody, and I'm not going to bore Jeremy with it, but anybody who doesn't know about Richard Larson, okay, he was a guy that went on the Pressure Luck in 84, and he broke the game. You have to understand, this is when the Apple IIe was just starting, okay? So Apple, you can, dramatize this a little bit. So what they did was, what CBS did is they had three different lighting patterns, and he would record it every single day, and he'd go home after work and watch the show, and he figured out the pattern. So I forgot what state he was from, but he goes to Los Angeles, gets on the show, and literally, and you can YouTube this, guys, for 9 minutes, he basically tens of thousands of dollars. And what ends up happening is that CBS, this is how standards and practice, they had it back with 21, but they had to really do a deep dive back into it because they were saying, oh, we cheated, this. No, he didn't cheat. He just figured it out. Anyways, long story short, they paid him the money. About a year later, he's listening to the radio. He hears an ad on the radio. If you can find the serial number on a $1 bill, we'll give you $5,000. So he goes to the bank. He takes out $10,000 in $1 bills. He has his wife and him combing through all these our bills. And after like the first 4 or 5 hours, the ex-wife, she said, I'm done. She takes the $5,000 in the dresser drawer and splits with the kid. He ends up, I think he passed away like 71, 72 years old, died of lung cancer. He actually, his last job was at Walmart Creator. So
yeah, you know, actually, that would be a very, not only would that be a good movie, but I could also see that there would be some probably really interesting cinematic ways to show how he did it. Because yeah, it you can watch this on YouTube because there was a game show. I remember that there was some documentary about this.
Oh yeah, no, the Pressure Luck documentary.
Yeah, he
remembered. They brought Tito Primark back. Yeah, and the contestants. Patterns,
and then just time. You had to be dead serious and time it just right to always hit the top money. But if he was like if he was a tenth of a second off on his timing, he would lose everything.
Well, not only that, he won yachts, he won trips, and you could tell in the tape he was visibly agitated.
Yeah,
like anybody would love a trip to Acapulco. He's like,
he's got on him. He's got the crowd screaming, completely bewildered by what the hell he's doing.
And Tamarkin had no idea.
I could see a very clever way. You could really find a way to cinematically bring that anxiety on screen, and you could show, find ways of showing like how he's like trying to lock in and like do the timing right.
Kind of like the Equalizer.
Everything is throwing him off. That could be a clever way.
It would be kind of like the Equalizer in the scene when the very first film when he's in with the Russian mobsters.
Yeah.
And he just slows down time and he looks around. That would be very, very unique. Yeah. So this has been a blast. Like I said, I know you're a busy guy and we might get some news, you know, later on today about all of this stuff. But anyways, Jeremy, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show because I had a blast talking with you.
Thanks
for having me. I'm going to keep using your pieces and, you know, you're more than welcome. We'll have you back probably at the end of the summer and just, see.
There'll be a lot to talk about how it all went down.
To talk about. Okay. So guys, that's the show for today. It's a little different. Like I said, a couple of things moving forward. Number one, we do have our perfect movie series coming up for June. It is going to be The Dark Knight. So stay tuned for that. Number two, I have not forgotten about the Patreon, guys. I finally got the link to actually go watch Training Day. So Mob Mondays is going to be for $5 per month, okay? And Rewatch Wednesday is going to be for $10. If you want both, I would advise doing that. Number three, we got a ton of stuff coming up on the channel for you guys. Spoiler casts, you know, Mission Impossible rewatches, all this stuff. It's free. So all I ask is you hit the like and subscribe button, gets it out there to everybody else. It keeps the interviews, you know, coming in like Mr. Fowler here. And yeah, that's it. Stay tuned for tomorrow. And oh, the last thing I'll say is this. The podcast, I am putting up some more podcasts. It is a process. I'm a month behind, so bear with me. Go to your favorite podcasting site, whether it's Spotify, Apple, or iHeartRadio. I will be putting them on SoundCloud at some point. And you guys, if you can't watch the videos, you guys will be getting your daily dose of real talks, you know, on your bike rides, on your workouts in the gym, at work, whatever it is, you guys will be able to hear that. Okay, guys, so that's going to do it for today. He's Jeremy Fowler. I'm David Steele. And you guys have been watching Real Talks. Bye-bye.